Good evening, and welcome to the Perpetual Notion Machine right here on Community Radio. I'm your host, Catherine Garvins. On tonight's show, we'll listen to part two of my interview with the editors of the book, Amphibians and Reptiles of Wisconsin. The book is a beautifully illustrated and definitive guide to the state's herpetofauna, available now from the University of Wisconsin Press. I spoke with Joshua M. Kopfer, certified wildlife biologist and a professor in the Department of Biological Science at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, and Donald J. Brown, certified wildlife biologist and research ecologist with the U.S. Forest Service Pacific Northwest Research Station in Washington State. Part 1 was broadcast on November 3rd, and you can find the full interview on the WORT website at www.wortfm.org. In Part 1, we discussed the book, as well as Wisconsin's salamanders, frogs, and toads. We join Part 2 as we are discussing Wisconsin's turtles.
I have a couple more comments.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, so for if you're out and about and you find a turtle on the road, there are a few likely candidates. It's likely to be, Josh, you can add if you think it's different, but a painted turtle, a snapping turtle, or a box turtle are going to be your likely turtles that mm-hmm. you're encountering on the roads. Once in a while, you might find something else like a wood turtle, but those are really common turtles that you often see along roads.
And people are always tempted to stop and help the turtle go in its intended direction. Is that a good practice or?
Yep. Absolutely. Okay. But the key is bring it in its intended direction,
right?
Not back. Don't go to like the shortest side of where it came from because it will just try to cross back.
Right. And of course, do it safely, obviously, if you're pulling alongside the road. But that's good to know because I always wondered about that, whether we're doing more harm than good.
It's ironic. Just this weekend, I was in Minnesota at a friend's house. And because of the warm weather, there were two different snapping turtles trying to cross roads in his neighborhood. The ponds had been drying up that they were overwintering in or planning to overwinter in. So they were trying to head to a lake, I think. But the snapping turtle, it brings up a good point. Not only do you have to watch out for traffic, but snapping turtles, they have the ability to cause a little bit of damage if they were to bite. And so you have to be careful about how you move a snapping turtle across the road, mm-hmm. not just the bite, but their claws. And most people don't first think, I need to pick this snapping turtle up and move it. But just to make sure that you're being very careful. And one way to get them across the road without having to actually pick them up is if you have something with a long handle, perhaps a snow shovel that you would use in the winter if your car got stuck, or even if you have a long-handled ice scraper, sometimes you can use that to get behind them and slide them across the road the way they're going to just keep yourself protected.
Sure.
And make sure that the turtle gets across the road. That's one thing that people frequently want to try and pick them up.
Yeah, and to add on to that, for people who haven't worked much with snapping turtles and just kind of see them out and about, their heads look really short when they're just out, but their necks are actually really, really long.
Okay.
And so you could be a foot away from a snapping turtle and it may be able to reach out and bite you. So
wow.
Keep your hands well away from its head.
Okay, that's very good to know. Sounds
like
something.
It's also true of the soft-shelled turtles.
Okay. Yeah.
Great big long neck. And if you're closer to the big rivers, then map turtles, too, are species that you might encounter on roads quite a bit.
Okay.
During the nesting season. Most of the time, not always, but most of the time, the turtles you would encounter along roads that aren't wandering around on land typically would be females that are heading up to nest somewhere. And so that's why it's really, it can be really devastating for turtle populations that, it's often the females that are getting hit on those roads. You're targeting one sex, basically, during the reproductive phase or when they were, going to lay eggs as part of the end of reproduction.
Mm-hmm.
So turtles face a lot of challenges, unfortunately.
And obviously that impacts just the generational reproduction then, if you kill the females bearing eggs.
And many of those turtle species can take a lot longer to reach maturity than we would think of with a small vertebrate. It can be easily over a decade for a number of the turtle species before they reach maturity.
Right.
It can approach 20 years for some of them, like Blanding's turtles, et cetera. Donald maybe knows more about that than I do.
Sure. So it takes about 18 years in the northern portion of its range for wood turtles to reach sexual maturity. So it's designed, if it makes it to maturity, it's designed to live for 100 years. And so that's one of the reasons we're seeing that with a bunch of these different late maturing species. Blanding's turtle is another one. They're declining because it doesn't take much of what we call additive mortality, which mm-hmm. is mortality above natural mortality, to cause population declines.
Sure.
Just based on their natural life history.
Interesting. Let's move on to lizards and snakes and talk about them. And then I kind of want to get back to this topic of overwintering.
I have a particular favorite snake in the state, and it's the snake that I did my dissertation research on, mm-hmm. and that's the gopher snake. And the gopher snake is, in Wisconsin, we have the subspecies of gopher snake, which is the bull snake. But we, you know, in the book focused on species level, not subspecies level so much. But the gopher snake is our largest snake in the state. There are historic records of it, you know, exceeding 6 feet. Mm-hmm. I have never seen one that large. I have seen them over 5 feet, and that's an impressive snake. They are a true constrictor. In other words, they wrap around their prey and restrict that prey's ability to expand or contract its chest cavity so that it essentially suffocates very, very quickly. You know, those little rodents, their hearts are beating really fast. So it happens quickly. It's not a prolonged endeavor. Mm-hmm. But they're rodent predators, primarily lots of small mammals. They will get small rabbits as well, which are lagomorphs. And they occasionally get ground nesting birds, but that's not their primary food source. It's usually mammals, small mammals. Mm-hmm. And they are another one of these sand, prairie kind of savanna, grassland type species. They need those habitats that, as I mentioned with the ornate box turtle, are declining and very rare in Wisconsin and the upper Midwest. But they have a particular habitat requirement that restricts their range in the state beyond just the need to exist in grasslands and prairies and savannas, and that's their overwintering habitat. So these large snakes have to be able to get below the frost line to survive the winter. Now, for smaller snakes, they can get in little rock crevices or the channels of dying tree roots and things like that, whereas something as large as a bull snake, and this is also true for our two rattlesnake species, they need big rock crevices that we typically associate with bluff habitats along the Wisconsin and the Mississippi rivers. And so those crevices are large enough, deep enough, and reliable enough to get below the frost line. I mean, surely here in southeastern Wisconsin, where I live, there are prairies, right? But we don't see bull snakes because they don't have a reliable overwintering source that is plentiful. I mean, there are animal burrows and things like that, but those don't remain in the same place year after year after year, like a big rocky outcrop would. So this is true of many amphibians and reptiles, multiple types of habitat requirements are necessary for them to persist. Mm. And it's the reasons why they struggle is because if one of those habitats goes away, it, you know, can basically greatly impact that species.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Donald, did you have a lizard or snake you'd like to talk about?
I'll just do so I'm not really a snake guy. That's Josh. Okay. Snakes are generally bycatch in my research. I can appreciate them, but I just don't really study them. But a few tidbits that I think are interesting. One is the diversity of snakes in Wisconsin relative to the other clades of organisms we talked about. We have more snakes than any of the other ones. We have about as many snakes as we have of all amphibians in the state. So that's interesting, and that has a lot to do with the southern portion of the state and the driftless area and the more open areas, which is good for a lot of different snake species. And the other thing I want to mention is we only have two venomous snakes in the state, the timber rattlesnake and the moss saga. That's important to know because, right, when people catch snakes, the immediate thought is it venomous? Because mm-hmm. that's danger. And if you can learn to ID the timber rattlesnake, which has a rattle, and a lot of other characteristics that are identifiable for the species. And a moss saga, then you can easily figure out that the snake you're holding, which I hope you're not holding it if it's venomous, but the snake you're holding is not one that needs to be killed.
Yeah.
The venomous snake should be killed either.
Yes.
True.
And both of those venomous snake species are quite rare and have restricted ranges in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. So the Massasauga is state endangered and it is federally threatened currently. So there's not many of them in the state. There's a handful of sites maybe where they mm-hmm. exist. And the timber rattlesnake is state threatened. So both of those snakes are quite rare compared to many of the other snakes. And I, you know, Donald, you know, brought up a good point in that I think one of the other biggest challenges that snakes face is that across the spectrum of amphibians and reptiles, they're probably the most maligned. Mm. So people are frequently terrified of snakes, whereas a salamander might not bother them that much, or a frog might not bother them, or a turtle, right? Mm. So snakes have a lot of, you know, on top of the habitat loss and all of these other things, there's heavy, heavy human persecution. I mean, people will drive out of their way to get on a road shoulder to run over a snake, right? Yeah. Which is really terrible. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so there's all of these challenges that these organisms face.
So I remember when I was a kid growing up in Southwest Wisconsin, we had a hill that we called Rattlesnake Hill. So the decline must have, has that just been over the last 30 years? Like, when did that really start?
Well, so the timber rattlesnakes were both subject to the rattlesnake bounty that was active in the state until the 70s.
That's
and
right.
So snakes, timber rattlesnakes can be particularly long lived, right? Like I had an individual that I had captured at a site when I was working on my dissertation and I had injected it with a microchip so I could identify it into the future. And I found that same timber rattlesnake, it was an adult then, and I found it around 10 years later, that same exact snake with undergraduate students of mine when we were doing work out in the Wisconsin River Valley. So they're really long lived. So you can have people impacting that population for a long time, but still have, you know, maybe adult individuals that have avoided the bounty hunters still showing up. And so they don't rattlesnakes like timber rattlesnakes don't reproduce every year frequently. So that means that they have, you know, maybe a 2 to 3 year interval between reproductive events. There's high mortality in the offspring. There is, you know, high mortality due to habitat loss. So those populations have steadily been declining over time. And so, and actually the Massasauga was listed as endangered, I think, in the 80s. The timber rattlesnake, I think, was put on the threatened list in the state in the 90s. So those have been, and part of it has nothing to do with, you know, how rare they are. Part of it has to do also with the fact that you need public support and political support to get things protected. And not many people want to protect rattlesnakes. It's not like pandas or, you know, things like that.
Sure.
So.
Yeah, and that public support thing really has been a struggle, not just in Wisconsin, but in all the states within the timber rattlesnakes range. This is a species that people are truly afraid of, and they fear, some people feel fear for their life when they encounter one. And regardless of their status, this is a species that people will often just kill. And so we've had that issue in West Virginia. Mm-hmm. I'm sure Wisconsin has that same issue. And it's really hard to recover species that people are actively seeking to destroy.
And at least now there's not monetary gain for doing it mm-hmm. because the bounty has been ceased. There's no bounty anymore. But right. That doesn't stop it from happening. And to Donald's point, when I was doing my work on bull snakes, that was an area where there were rattlesnakes as well. And many of the private landowners in the area, when I contact them and say, hey, you know, can I access your property because I think there's a snake that I'm tracking on the land? They were almost across the board all the farmers there liked bull snakes, right? And gopher snakes because they ate rodents. Mm-hmm. But many of them did not appreciate timber rattlesnakes because they're dangerous potentially. So mm-hmm. even people that will put up with snakes sometimes don't appreciate the venomous species.
So I wanted to go back briefly on this topic of overwintering. I think you mentioned that they overwinter beneath the frost line. So can you say a little bit about exceptions to that and exactly how that works? Talk a little bit about that overwintering cycle.
I'll just do a few notes, and then Josh, if you want to take over. So many species do have to overwinter below the frost line, or they'll perish during the winter. But some species are adapted to surviving freezing. They essentially have a physiological adaptations that have cryoprotectants that allow them to live through it. Wood frog is sort of the poster species for that, where they can freeze solid and then unfreeze in the spring. And so one thing I'll note that's interesting is turtles. I mentioned that wood turtles overwinter at the bottom of the stream. So turtles have evolved to be able to absorb oxygen through the water, mostly through their cloaca, not entirely, but mostly through their cloaca, which is they breathe through their butts, people like to say. So that's kind of an interesting factoid. And each species has its own tolerance for more or less anoxic conditions. And so a wood turtle is on the lesser end of that, which is why they have to overwinter in streams where there's a constant flow of water coming through. So it's more oxygenated water versus a snapping turtle that can be in a wetland that is highly anoxic and can survive through the winter. Yeah, in addition, they basically turn their system off. Mm-hmm. So they don't need, they're not using really any energy at that point. They're ectothermic animals. They essentially have the equivalent of a pilot light through the winter. So they're not really needing the oxygen much either. And that helps them survive through the winter.
Yeah, the strategies that amphibians and reptiles use to survive the winter are really diverse. I mean, Donald talked about, you know, the different strategies with turtles, the frogs. Snakes don't have the ability to physiologically produce cryoprotectants. Some species will overwinter at the sort of water-land interface, but it has to be in a location that doesn't freeze solid. So we see some species that live close to water overwintering in, for example, crayfish burrows that go down, and the water within that crayfish burrow kind of rises and falls as the water level of the adjacent water body does, and the snake can follow that, but they typically can't survive if that area becomes totally frozen. Or if there's spring floodings that draw or force those snakes out of those crayfish burrows before it's warm enough, they get pushed out, then there's a sudden freeze and the snake can't survive that. The other type of overwintering we see in things like snakes would be the use of existing crevices, burrows. Most snakes are not creating their own burrows for the winter. They're using an existing structure or the abandoned burrow of another organism, or I'd mentioned before the root channels for a dead tree that are starting to rot and allow a space for the little snake to get down into. So they need something that gets below where frost penetrates in the winter. And in Wisconsin, that penetration can be fairly deep. We usually think about roughly 3 feet, right, for the max penetration of frost up here. Obviously, there's variation in that. So if they don't have a place to overwinter, they won't persist in a location. So that's why that overwintering habitat is so critical.
Sure. So we're coming up on the last few minutes here, and I wanted to talk a bit about the conservation of these guys in Wisconsin. If we want to discuss the Wisconsin Frog and Toad Survey, also, you know, what our listeners can do to help these species succeed in the state.
Yeah, I'll start with the Wisconsin Frog and Toad Survey. Mm-hmm. So that began in 1981, and that was Wisconsin was the first state to implement a statewide frog and toad survey for long-term monitoring. And eventually it was started in response to declines of anurans in the state. But ultimately that initiative was brought to a national level run by USGS, and it was modeled off of the Wisconsin Frog and Toad Survey, which is kind of a neat thing. And since then, it has been ended at the national level, but Wisconsin continues annually to do this Frog and Toad Call Survey. So it's produced some really interesting and useful data for us. And in the book, we have trajectories or trends of each species based on the survey data. And so we have both occupancy and abundance trends that can be derived from that. And it's a relative metric, so it shouldn't be treated as truth, but it's a gauge for how each of our anurans species are doing in the state.
I think a critical component of the Frog and Toad Call Survey too is that it is a citizen science project. In other words, it requires volunteers to work, and people have volunteered to go out and, you know, listen for amphibians and reptile, or I'm sorry, not reptiles, listen to amphibian calls. And so without input or buy-in from the general public, that important survey does not happen.
So is there anything else that we didn't touch on that you think is important for our listeners to know, either about this area of study or your book?
There's one thing that I just want to mention, and you can use this or not. And Donald and I have never actually spoken directly about this, but this book came about because Donald and I had never met. We had never talked to each other. We didn't know each other. And even after this 9 years that this book has went on, mm-hmm. we have only met face-to-face, I think, three times. Once? No, there was twice, because one time you had to pick something up from me, and I was at a Chuck E. Cheese. I don't know if you remember that. But for a birthday party. But we had never, and even those meetings were probably 5 minutes, right, at most. We didn't. So we have only ever discussed and worked remotely, through email, electronically, through things like Zoom, et cetera. And so this book, the fact that it came about is really profound, because Donald and I were sort of introduced by a third party. And, you know, the need for this book to happen was something that all of us shared. And that's how we got started on this process. Mm. And I look back on it now, and to get into such a massive project with somebody that you barely know, of course, we didn't know how massive the project was at the time. It sort of snowballed as we went through it. But mm-hmm. without, you know, I am so thankful to have met Donald this way, and that he was involved in the book, because he has skill sets that I do not have. And I needed him to be involved. This book would have never happened on my end anyways.
Yeah, and I'll note that the magnitude of this book is because of Josh. So the original vision for this book was maybe half the size of what it turned into. And as, like Josh said, it snowballed as we went along. And as scientists, we really look for one-stop shops to get what we need. And we often find ourselves going to what we call the Bibles, which are of the United States and Canada. So there's mm-hmm. the salamanders of the United States and Canada, and the Nurins, a snakes, a turtles. We use that as our model for our species account, but we catered it to Wisconsin in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. So it's not the same as those accounts, but we tried to make it as comprehensive as those accounts. And like I said earlier, we also have quite a bit of originally published data in this book that hasn't been published before. So we think this is going to be a really useful resource for scientists, for naturalists, for just people interested in amphibians and reptiles, because of the way we wrote it, mm-hmm. where people can understand what it's about. And so that was our goal. That's what we tried to do.
I really think that you succeeded in that regard, and I'm grateful that this collaboration came together. It is a big book, clocks in at over 1,000 pages, very comprehensive, but also, as I noted earlier, very easy for the non-scientists to use and understand.
I want to just mention real quick, too, the importance of all of our contributing authors. We've talked a lot. We've spoken a lot just in general as if we've done everything, but the book could not have happened without the buy-in from all of these contributors that were interested enough to, you know, share their expertise with us. And so that's a critical component of this book. And one of the things that separates it from many of the other books like it in other regional sort of field guide type books mm-hmm. or regional books on different types of critters.
Right. Thank you, Donald.
And then I'd also like to acknowledge the individuals and agencies that provided funding for the book. And what that did was it allowed us to reduce the cost of this book by approximately $50. So we've got it. It's a large book, but it's a manageable cost given the size of the book. And again, mm-hmm. as Josh said earlier, all full color figures. That's not cheap to print. And there were a lot of donors for the book, but particularly I want to point out I'm from West Virginia, the Wisconsin mm-hmm. Department of Natural Resources, which donated about half of our total money donations for the mm-hmm. book.
We also got huge contributions from the Milwaukee Public Museum as well. And so, you know, I don't want to keep us, but of course we could talk about this subject forever. But I also would like to mention, again, you can use this if you want to or not, but we were very, very dependent on museum specimen collections for aspects of this. Okay. And museum specimen collections are one of those things, sometimes even among scientists, they're viewed as a thing of the past, right? A bunch of specimens preserved in jars. They take up a lot of space. They take up a lot of resources. But the importance of those specimens is very, very high for not just efforts like our book, but also future conservation efforts. I mean, we went through many, many museum specimens at the Milwaukee Public Museum, but also the University of Wisconsin-Madison Zoology Museum. Mm-hmm. And these were historical specimens that provide definitive evidence that a species was present or was not present in an area 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. And today, now we have this record of that to say, well, look, these were here at one point in time. So what does that tell us? So we spent hundreds of hours in museum collections working on looking at specimens, using them for our range maps. I had a huge number of undergraduate researchers that spent a lot of time working on it as well and helping me out. And so we just want to highlight that because those institutions don't receive enough support today in the modern world and in the even among scientists. And so we think that is a very important part of being a scientist, especially in the natural sciences.
Sure. Well, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time. And I wish you very good luck with the book. It's beautiful and very accessible. And I look forward to seeing where it goes. So thank you so much for your time today, both of you.
Thank you very much, Catherine, for having us.
You bet. You are listening to the Perpetual Notion Machine on community-supported radio in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm your host, Catherine Garvins. I've been speaking with Joshua M. Kopfer, certified wildlife biologist and a professor in the Department of Biological Science at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, and Donald J. Brown, certified wildlife biologist and research ecologist with the U.S. Forest Service Pacific Northwest Research Station in Washington State. You can find the full interview on our website at www.wortfm.org. Have a good evening.